Exodus chapter 4. So in our study through Exodus, this is now message number 5, entitled, Send Somebody Else. Exodus chapter 4, we're going to be looking at verses 1 to 17, and to get started, I'm just going to read verse 1. And Moses answered and said, But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord hath not appeared unto thee. So on September 22nd, 1957, Ted Williams was born in Brooklyn. And around ninth grade, he was on a school field trip and he met a radio announcer and was quite shocked that the man didn't look at all like what he thought he would look like, because all he'd ever done was heard his voice on the radio. But that did start his fascination with professional voice work, such as radio announcing, voiceover work, that sort of thing. It sort of set the course for his life. Well, after high school, he served some time in the Army, and then he went on to school for voice acting and landed a job in the early 80s in Columbus, Ohio for a radio station, and he began to become somewhat well-known for his voice. Now, in the later 80s, though, he became more interested in drugs and alcohol than he did voice acting, and ultimately in 1994, he ended up being fired from that same radio station. Well, the next 17 years of his life involved more drugs, more alcohol, homelessness, some stints in jail. But in January 2011, there was an employee of the Columbus Dispatch, the primary newspaper there in Columbus, Ohio, who worked in the video department and decided to stop along the street where there was a homeless man standing in the median there at a stoplight at the intersection with a sign that read, I have a God-given gift of voice. I'm an ex-radio announcer who has fallen on hard times. Please, any help will be gratefully appreciated. Thank you and God. So as he pulled over and rolled his window down, he's videoing this whole thing, and he asked this man, well, give me a sample of this God-given voice that you have, which he did, and delivered really a perfect sort of impromptu radio promo spot. The video, of course, ended up posted, ended up on YouTube, went viral, and Ted Williams became known as the man with the golden voice. Offers of jobs and help, and all these things began pouring in. Didn't happen right away. He had quite a few setbacks, but seems like, as far as I can tell, he seemed to finally get his life on track. So Ted Williams was a man that got a second chance at life, something that few people truly get in that way. But if he didn't have a God-given gift of voice, he would have been just another homeless man who got a buck at a stoplight and would have probably turned that buck into a bottle once he had enough of them, and may have never got off of the streets. Well, Moses was sort of a homeless man in Midian. He was a stranger in a strange land who had fallen from being prince in Egypt to shepherd in the desert. Moses was not the man with the golden voice, and I don't know what the opposite of that is exactly, but that's what Moses was. But he was about to get a second chance of sorts, and he seemed somewhat reluctant. Well, in chapter 3, Exodus begins to give us a significant contrast with what we read in the first two chapters. In fact, chapters 1 and 2 could almost seem like a secular history of Israel in Egypt. We read of Jacob's migration to Egypt that's facilitated by Joseph, peace and prosperity in the land of Goshen, deaths of the original generation, regime change in Egypt, and then a series of tragic events with Israel in slavery. And though chapter 2 did introduce Moses and his family and their faith, Moses ends up being exiled in Midian, with Israel's circumstances just continuing to grow worse. And through all of that, in those first couple of chapters, God seemed silent, seemed distant, even though His blessings are evident in the extraordinary growth of Israel, which also only seemed to compound their problems. Well, it's unsurprising that chapter 2 ends with language that is most known and most common to us today, that is featured in the Lament Psalms. That question of why God is silent, why God hasn't acted, why is He apparently absent and so far away? Well, we've studied all the Lament Psalms, and we know that those laments are covenantal prayers that question God's absence or His inaction, because there is an expectation for Him to act because of His covenant promises. In other words, if God has sworn to do something, well, why aren't you doing it, is essentially what many of the Lament Psalms ask. So the chapter 2 ended using those terms of specifying that God saw, heard, knew, and remembered, things that are common in the lament language of the Psalms. But they also indicated that He was about to act. And so chapter 3 breaks that silence and absence with God's presence, with God's voice, which continues throughout the book of Exodus. He appears in a burning bush to Moses and speaks to him to call him to lead Israel out of Egypt. And He gave the greatest assurance possible to Moses in the promise, "I will be with you." He said that in verse number 12. He gave him a sign of His presence, and the sign of His presence was that Israel would come out of Egypt into that mountain, and Moses would know assuredly that God was with him. And what this meant was that God's presence would be unmistakable, and it would be effective. Now, God reveals His name to Moses in chapter 3 to give to the children of Israel. Of course, His name is the surety of the covenant that He swore to Abraham. And this chapter maintains that connection with Genesis that we noted from the very start of the book of Exodus, which also explains the crying out of Israel and the hearing and remembering by God. But now, in chapter 3, God has come down and things are about to happen. So chapter 4 continues this conversation between the Lord and Moses at the burning bush on the mount in Horeb. And the last part of this conversation is what we get here in verses 1 to 17 of chapter 4. And this part of this conversation particularly reveals Moses' reluctance. And it rises to this peak in verse number 13, where he simply asks God to just send somebody else. His reluctance is quite a contrast from the Egyptian prince who killed another Egyptian to revenge his Hebrew brother. Well, his reluctance is accounted for by his doubts about his own abilities. We don't read of Moses ever doubting the promises that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We don't ever read of him doubting that. We don't ever read of Moses doubting that God has the ability to bring Israel out of Egypt according to His word. But Moses was full of doubt about his own abilities to be able to do what God was calling him to do. But of course, if we look at it thematically, his reluctance contributes to the revelation in this book of who God is and what He does and why. So in verses 1 to 9, we read about the three signs that God gives to Moses so that Israel will know that He had sent him. And in verses 10 to 17, we see Moses' case for being unfit to lead Israel out of Egypt. So we'll begin with the first part here in verses 1 to 9. We'll start with verse 1 again. "And Moses answered and said, 'But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord hath not appeared unto thee.'" So as this conversation is progressing between the Lord and Moses there at the burning bush, Moses has raised certain questions about this mission already, and mainly those questions are revolving around who Moses is. Who am I to go into Pharaoh? Who am I to go to Israel? And he has quite a low esteem among the Israelites in Egypt, at least in his own estimation. Moses had fled from Egypt decades prior to this in fear and in some disgrace from the face of his people. And even though we love a good character redemption story, we love stories like that where someone really truly gets a second chance and makes good on it. But Moses is a man who doesn't see any such second chance for him. Moses objected that the people of Israel that God had just told him in the previous chapter to go to, they're not going to believe me. They're not going to believe me that you've appeared to me, that you're going to lead them out and so on. And that term for believing and that concept of believing, it is thematic in the book of Exodus. It's thematic in this account in particular. The term itself appears five times by verse number 9 here in chapter 4. And then three more times in certain key places in the book of Exodus up to chapter number 19. And this raises an important question in the book about whether Israel will believe God or not. Let's look at verses 2 and 3. And the Lord said unto him, what is that in thine hand? And he said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it. Well, verses 2 to 3, God gives the first of three signs for Moses that will confirm his words to Israel. And God starts by drawing attention to the staff that is in Moses' hand. Now, the word that is used here, translated rod, some of the newer translations, I think, say staff. The word that is used here is a word for a stick or a branch. That would be the literal sense of the term. It is used a little more figuratively to refer to a tribe or a clan, and that would, I guess, would be similar to how we might talk about a branch of the family tree or something along that line. It's a word that is different from the word that is commonly used for scepter, although this word for staff, it is used in Psalm 110 and verse number 2 to describe the rod of the Messiah over the nations in the future kingdom, but most often that rod is even referred to as a scepter with a different word. So in terms of a rod, this word is used more of a shepherd's staff. And it is an important symbol as Moses appears to Pharaoh as a foreign shepherd to shepherd the flock of Israel and lead them out of Egypt. Well, he obeys God and he casts it to the ground and it becomes a snake. And snakes were obviously important symbols in ancient Egypt mythology, and as I understand, they were associated with certain particular goddess in their worship. They were a part of the symbology for the pharaohs and for the ruling power and such in Egypt and things. And so obviously, this is indicative of God's power over Egypt, his war, you might say, with their false worship as well. Verses 4 to 5. And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth thine hand and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath appeared unto thee. So the sign is here explained. Moses obeyed, he catches the snake by the tail, and it became a staff once again. And this anticipates that coming judgment on Egypt and the reversal of the Pharaoh's power. And this sign, God said, is to confirm to Israel that the I Am has sent Moses and he has spoken through Moses. And notice again in verse 5, we have this continued reference to the fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And so God is in essence here at this point revealing himself to this generation of Israel like he did to those fathers so long ago. Verses 6 to 8. And the Lord said furthermore unto him, put now thine hand into thy bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. And he said, put thine hand into thy bosom again. And he put his hand into his bosom again and plucked it out of his bosom. And behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, that they will believe the voice of the latter sign. So verses 6 to 8 now give us the second sign for Moses. And this word leprous, or this word for leprosy, describes some kind of skin disease, not exactly what we call or know of leprosy today. It is and seems to be a word that can be somewhat general and can cover maybe a few different types of infections and problems. But regardless of the exact nature of it, leprosy is presented to us as incurable. It's something, in essence, that according to the law, the lepers would be put out from the camp. And only a miraculous act of God could heal this leprosy or remove it so that they rejoined Israel in the camp. So this incurable leprosy, this is a sign, and God demonstrated here His power over creation and even disease as Moses' hand was restored whole. And obviously this healing significantly anticipates the healing of hard hearts through the new covenant, something we studied about not too long ago. And this healing is also, as we see in verse 8, is joined together with the believing of Israel. And again, another sort of foreshadowing of that new covenant and the problem that Israel had with the old one. Verse 9, and it shall come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, neither hearken unto thy voice, that thou shalt take of the water of the river and pour it upon the dry land, and the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. Well, this third sign was only described, it wasn't demonstrated before Moses, but Moses was instructed to take water from the Nile and to pour it out onto the ground, and he's assured that it would turn to blood when he did so. And of course, this anticipates the coming plague judgment on Egypt when that very thing did happen. These signs also foreshadow the future day of the Lord judgment. Well, it brings us to the second part and the conclusion of this particular conversation that begins here in verse number 10, where Moses argues himself to be unfit for this. Verse 10, and Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. So this is now Moses' fourth objection that he has raised to his leading Israel out of Egypt. And Moses says, in essence, that he was not well spoken. There are a lot of ideas out there about what this means. The language here, as I understand, in the original is not quite specific. The Septuagint translation actually used language of stuttering and stammering, and I think led many people to conclude that Moses had some sort of a speech impediment. That's not actually in the text, though. Others have suggested, well, you know, Moses has been 40 years out of Egypt. He's been spending a lot of time with the sheep, who are not generally speaking great conversationalists, and he's in the desert, he's not having a lot of human contact. His Egyptian language is probably quite rusty, and maybe he's concerned about being able to communicate on a high level that would be required in Pharaoh's court. There are others that suggest that, well, maybe all of his time in the desert as well is just simply he's lost the diplomatic skill and the training and all of these sort of things. Well, we're not told any of those things, and I certainly can't confirm or deny those things to be the case. But whatever the exact problem is, what Moses says essentially is that I cannot speak well. I can't speak well. Moses sees his own limitations, his own lack of ability, as disqualifying him for such a mission that God is calling him to. Verses 11 and 12. And the Lord said unto him, Who hath made man's mouth, or who maketh the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say. So God responds to Moses' objection here. And he gives, here in verse 11, a great revelation of his sovereign power over creation. He is the maker and knows more of Moses' abilities and lack thereof than even Moses himself understands. But more than this, he says he makes the blind, he makes the seeing, he makes the deaf, he makes the hearing, and so on. And he makes them for his own purpose. Now, I just can't help but think at this point about the man born blind in John chapter 9 and how that the apostles asked Jesus who it was that had sinned. In other words, who is at fault that this man has been born this way and has grown to an adult this way? And Jesus, of course, responded to them saying that the man's blindness wasn't a judgment. It wasn't a punishment for any particular sin, but his blindness was for the glory of God, and Jesus healed the man. And so God just simply draws Moses' attention to the fact that, well, you know, who made your mouth, Moses? Who was it that put you together in your mother's womb? Who was it that invested you with the various traits and qualities and characteristics, those sort of inherent things that you have, not learned traits, but things that you were simply born with? Well, who's responsible for that? And obviously the answer is, have not I the Lord? God has done that. Now, there are a couple of very important implications when thinking about God's sovereignty in this way. And one of those is that our limitations, my limitations, your limitations, and we all have limitations. There are things we cannot do. There are things that we can do, and some things we can do well, some things we can't do quite as well, and some things we just can't do at all. We all have limitations. But our limitations do not limit God. They don't hinder or prevent God or render Him unable to accomplish His purpose. They limit us, but they do not limit Him. And then secondly, whatever it is that we do have, it has come from God. Whatever those natural abilities and things are, it's come from Him. But the opposite of that is also true. Those that we don't have also come from God in the sense that He didn't give those to us, for His own purpose. We are so often discontent with what we have received, and oftentimes we're just plain envious of others who have received something that we haven't, that we feel like, boy, if I just had that. But through faith, what we have and what we don't have are completely sufficient to glorify God with our lives. So these are important for us to understand when thinking about sovereignty this way. And the Lord goes on to just tell Moses in light of this, I've made your mouth, and I'll be with your mouth. Go, therefore. Moses' limitations, again, did not limit or hinder God's purpose to deliver Israel. Verse 13, and he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. Now, obviously, the language of this verse is quite a bit difficult. But essentially, Moses is just simply asking the Lord to send somebody else. That's what the meaning is. If Moses ever thought of himself as being fit for this job, he didn't think so any longer. He thought that time was past, if he ever did think he was fit for such a job. And really, I think we can see that Moses has sort of run out of questions and objections. Verses 14 to 16. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well, and also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee, and when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart. And thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what you shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of a God." So this is essentially the Lord's final response to Moses in this conversation, the burning bush appearance. And we're told that he was angry with Moses at this point for his reluctance to obey, and that's really what was going on with Moses at this point. And he gave Moses sort of a sign. He said, "Well, Aaron will come to meet you." And he identified Aaron as the Levite, obviously foreshadowing the old covenant priesthood that will be established. And Moses was to take Aaron with him, and he would be the spokesman for Moses. And God assured Moses that he would speak through them both. Now, Moses is said here that he will be as God or as Elohim to Aaron, and Aaron would be his mouth or his mouthpiece or his prophet. So he's actually elevating the status of Moses, not to divinity or anything of that sort. But as he goes before Pharaoh, as well as to the children of Israel, he's going to be presented quite differently. And this is also a case of the elder serving the younger, as Aaron was the older brother to Moses, echoing that obvious patriarch narrative from Genesis. And again, highlighting, just as it does there, the sovereign choice of God according to his own purpose. Verse 17, "And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs." Now the last word is for Moses to keep his staff and to take it with him. Moses would go on to appear symbolic of a shepherd king coming to conquer Egypt with his staff when he comes before Pharaoh. Now again, Moses, that we know of, didn't question God's ability to bring Israel out of Egypt, but he did question his own ability to facilitate and to lead such an exodus. And as God answered Moses' objections, he was reduced to simply pleading with God that he had the wrong guy. You need to pick somebody else. And his reluctance was again centered on his own lack of ability, things that he believed would be required for such a task. And the truth is, most of us shrink back from what we perceive to be really big tasks. We shrink back from that sort of thing. And with quite a bit of irony, we often feel ourselves to be too small for a really big job, while at the same time thinking of ourselves as too big for a really small job. Well, the talents and abilities that we have, they're not random, and they're not accidental. And I know sometimes maybe we use, or you've heard the term, the genetic lottery, and if you studied genes and all of that sort of thing, it's fascinating, and all that sort of thing. But the Bible is telling us that these things aren't random. It's not a random chance that you are who you are and made up of all the things that you are. They have been given to us by God. It could be a golden voice, like in the case of someone like Ted Williams, or it could be something else. But whatever it is, we are to use them in God's service and for His glory. And also, we should not look down on and despise others who maybe don't have some of the things that we do. The talents and the abilities that we don't have are also purposeful. There's a reason that God didn't give us whatever it is that we would like to have and maybe even think we should have. And we shouldn't be envious of those who do have them. Now, while we are reading this account and thinking a lot about ourselves, we don't want to miss the significance of this account in prefiguring Jesus Christ. Moses was reluctant to the call, much like others, such as Gideon and Isaiah and Jeremiah. But Jesus willingly humbled himself to the status of a slave to completely obey the Father when that meant his own death on the cross. Moses would later tell Israel that God would send them a greater prophet like Moses, whom they must listen to. So Moses obviously prefigured and foreshadowed the coming of Christ, and maybe never more so than when he is to appear before Pharaoh as a God and a shepherd king with his staff and his prophet to conquer Egypt and gather the chosen nation out to bring them to the land of promise. Well, Christ himself will come to the earth as God and king with his staff to conquer the nations, and he will gather his people Israel out of all nations and restore them to the Lamb with new hearts to follow him.